This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
DC for you. DC for you. DC for you. DC for you.
Place to Be Nation Pop is the spookiest month of the year. It's October here on DC for you, and that means it's time to get into a little DC horror showcase. All the scariest stories from DC Comics that make your spine tingle and all the hairs on your arms and back stand up. And I mean, that's a lot for me. I am a very hairy individual, as you might have guessed. That's neither here nor there. But joining me, of course, I am one of your co-hosts, Russell Sellers. Joining me, as always, the co-host, the owner, the manager extraordinaire, producer extraordinaire, Todd Weber.
Wow, it feels like it was just August. But it's already October, man.
Yeah, and it's not any cooler outside.
No, what an Indian summer we are having. We're going to talk some scary DC stuff, or at least horror-themed DC stuff.
Yeah.
As opposed to horror-themed DC stuff, which is, we'll not work blue today.
Yeah, we're not discussing Scott Lobdell's turn on Teen Titans.
Hey-o! Mm.
Or more pointedly, his Red Hood and the Outlaws, and the New 52 era. Anyway, but we're going to get into some actual like scary stories at DC because we figured this was a good time of year to talk about something very different from our usual stuff, because we talk a lot of superhero stuff, and I'm sure that some of that's going to creep in with this talk, but. DC has quite a history with horror comics, as I understand it. I mean, I've seen some real classics come out of their Vertigo line, and even some stuff come out of the main line.
Yeah, you can go way back till, let's say, the late 60s, early 70s, Bronze Age, and you had the anthology titles of House of Mystery, House of Secrets, and those were books that had, done in one tales from the days of creepy or EC Comics almost,
yeah,
where there were very kind of, I won't say scandalous, but just tales on the dark side, usually with a host of a sort. You had Cain and Abel, and one of the other books had a character named Eve, so it had kind of a creepy biblical association to it, and generally done by guys like Joe Orlando and Len Wein and Jim Aparo on art, guys like that. Very, very rich tradition of history, of horror books at DC.
Absolutely, and some of those books could even be controversial because of the graphic nature of them. And that's actually a tradition that kind of continued on into the modern era when it came to DC's approach to the horror genre. But we thought for this episode that we should give the audience a little cross-section of our favorite horror stories. And in the second half, we're going to talk about a movie that's probably a little divisive between the two hosts here. We'll be discussing the Keanu Reeves Constantine film. So with that in mind, let's just go ahead and fully rip off our good brothers over at the HTF, sponsored by Blue Chew, and get into our countdown of our top three horror comics. We're not going to hit you with five. We're just going to do three each and discuss what makes these books really good. Like, what makes them a good horror story, why we think these are the books that would be perfect for you to jump into for this upcoming Halloween season. So with that in mind, Todd, I want you to kick us off. What's at number three for you on your DC horror picks?
Well, let's talk about that. I made a big list, and then I whittled it down to just three. So we'll maybe talk about my honorable mention when we get closer to number one, but I will start with, like I was just saying, a classic DC horror title, and this is House of Mystery number 201. Oh, nice. This is a 7-page story found in House of Mystery, and it's called The Demon Within. Now, this is something that you read it now, you maybe not be super terrified of it, but when I read it when I was a little boy, it was quite frightening. This is a 1972 dated story. I first read it, I believe, in a Treasury comic entitled The Best of DC Volume 1. Treasury meaning an oversized comic, like a absolute edition size, but soft cover. This was a comic collection that had a bunch of kind of heritage titles by DC. So you had the a classic 3-part Superman Kandor Bottled City story, and a great Batman story was in there. You had a Joe Kubert story about Firehair the Indian, but the story that stuck out to me was called The Demon Within. Again, 7-page story, great art by Jim Aparo. This story is about a young boy who can transform into a monster and terrorizes his family, and the solution they come up with to take care of it ends up kind of taking care of the problem, but taking care of all the good stuff too. So I wouldn't say it's traditionally scary, but as a kid, it really freaked me out because of the art specifically. Written by Joe Orlando, and I'm not sure who scripted it, but I know it was Aparo who did the art. Something that sticks with me to this day, and now you read it in this day and you say, oh, this is obviously a metaphor for, I won't say autism, but ADHD kids and Ritalin and medication. And so it's very interesting that they would publish that story so early, but it's definitely got the you can read it on two levels thing. So have you ever seen that story?
I have not, but that is one that I am like, I'm familiar with its existence because that is a one that kind of sticks out whenever you start talking about DC and horror comics. It usually comes up at the top of most lists whenever you see stuff in the genre of horror from DC.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm not sure. Was it available on DC Universe? I don't remember.
You know, I didn't look because I looked at my hard copies, but I am on DC Universe right now, so I'll have an answer to that in just a second. House of Secrets or House of Mystery number 201.
And I do believe that House of Mystery did wind up on DC Universe. It was kind of a surprise because they were talking like the Vertigo stuff and Black Label probably wouldn't be added to DC Universe. But then out of the blue...
This was predates that, though.
Ah, okay. But some Vertigo stuff has actually been creeping its way onto the service, which I'm hoping means that by the time this episode is out and people are hearing it, that some of the stuff we're talking about will be available so people can just pull up the app and enjoy it. But as it stands, I think that some of the stuff we're going to talk about is definitely not going to be on there. But my number three is definitely already on DC Universe. People can go check that out right now because this is a Superman story. And people, I know that sounds a little strange because people don't necessarily associate Superman with horror comics. And under most circumstances, you'd be right. But this is a story called Under the Skin. It was written by Greg Pak and illustrated by Aaron Cooter. And it appeared in the pages of Action Comics number 36 through 40. It's collected as Superman Action Comics Volume 7. This is from the New 52 era. And the basic gist of this is it occurs as kind of a standalone story. It is in continuity with the Superman books that were running at the time. But this is really its own thing. You could definitely just pick this up and read it as a single story. The basic premise is this strange mist has descended on Smallville, Kansas, and has kind of cut it off from the rest of the outside world. Of course, this is going to draw Superman's attention immediately, and when he shows up, he finds everyone in the town still seems to be moving around. They're alive, but they don't quite seem like themselves. They all know him. They all have their memories and can recall things that happened in their lives, because in this continuity, it seems like everybody in Smallville knows that Clark and Superman are one and the same. But they're not themselves. They all kind of speak with this same voice. And there's a lot of, like, the way I would describe some of the monster stuff that's lurking out in the shadows is very, like, Cthulhu-esque is how it comes off. So you've got some real Lovecraftian horror mixed in with this. It's got a little bit of that body horror stuff going on, as well as a haunted house slash haunted town thing. And, of course, Superman dare not actually physically harm any of these people, because these are still the people that he grew up with. These are still, like, normal human beings who are possessed by a collective conscious. It's a big mystery to how it all is happening and how it all works. The hive mind that's actually, like, controlling everything around him is bringing out all of Superman's worst fears. It's really chilling stuff, and the artwork from Aaron Cooter is at, I think, the top of his game when it came to his time on Action Comics with Greg Pak. Like, they had a great run all the way through, but this story really stuck with me after I read it. It was this and the very first story arc they did that introduced Ghost Soldier. Those are two of my absolute favorite Superman stories. This one is just so different from everything that I have ever seen in a Superman book, and it will chill you to the bone at times because of the weird headspace that this mind-controlling entity does to Clark while he's trapped in Smallville with these folks, because once he's entered the mist, he can't leave either. I don't want to give away who, like, the big reveal that comes along with this. Longtime Superman fans, longtime DC fans will get a kick out of it. I think I certainly did whenever the big reveal was made, because it's a pretty classic character who makes their new 52 return in this, and it's good stuff. You can absolutely find all of those issues on DC Universe right now, and I would highly recommend it for some of these late nights or some of these dark nights during the month of October. It'd be a great one to sit down with and see that not only are there multiple aspects to Superman, but you can get just a really great, chilling, very different kind of horror story than what you might be expecting.
Would I have trouble pronouncing the name of the person behind the big reveal?
You would absolutely not.
Oh, okay. Never mind. So it's not that guy. No. It is on that's a blind spot for me, New 52 Superman, or Action Comics. I think I just read the Morrison stuff at the beginning, and it was okay. It was all right. Yeah. I just read the Perez Superman stuff at the beginning in New 52. Hey, whatever happened to that New 52 Superman anyway?
He died. Right as the as the New 52 was concluding, they did a story arc called The Last Days of Superman, where the New 52 Superman had this big crossover with all of his titles, and ultimately meets his end as that story concludes. And the pre-New 52 Superman, who had been revealed to be on the same Earth pretty much from the beginning of the New 52, just in hiding, steps up to become Superman once again. And, of course, that all leads into the Peter Tomasi and Patrick Gleason run on Superman, which is absolutely tremendous, and has a big crossover with Dan Jurgens' Action Comics during the Superman Reborn arc, which essentially says that it was their take on Superman Red and Blue, that the pre-New 52 Superman was Superman Blue, that Superman Red was the New 52 Superman, and that these were two halves of a whole who were now restored to one at the end of that story arc. So it's really good stuff. I would actually highly recommend reading The Last Days of Superman. I actually thought that was done really well. It was also done by Peter Tomasi. And most of Greg Pak's Action Comics is also very, very good. So there are places where the New 52 Superman is very good, and then there's the majority of it where it's just kind of, it ranges from eh to, wow, that was pretty bad.
Yeah, it was searching for some footing for a long time until maybe Tomasi and Pak, guys like that, came on. Pak, I'd say, is an underrated writer. I've really liked his stuff on the Hulk over the years, over at Marvel, but his DC stuff is few and far between.
It is. He's a rarity in the DC library, but I really liked how he wrote Superman. He actually took the New 52 Superman and gave him a personality, so that was a big step in the right direction, and it kind of sucked that he didn't get to steer that ship completely on his own, because I think he could have really taken Superman in some great directions. But yeah, Under the Skin is a great just one-off story between issues 36 and 40 of that Action Comics volume. So I think that could definitely get somebody into his run, even though this comes near the end or at the end of his run on that title.
Right on. Well, I accuse others of recency bias fairly often, but I am going to commit it, and I'm going to say my number two creepy, scary monster story is actually Deceased, recently published by DC Comics. Deceased, written by Tom Taylor with art by Trevor Herzine. This is, we would call it perhaps an Elseworlds story. It takes place outside of main continuity, but it's not a Black Label story. It's a traditional published right under the DC imprint, and this one is the ultimate DC zombie story, I would say. Darkseid wins. Darkseid
is
as Tom King would say in Mr. Miracle, he is. But Darkseid wins and corrupts many of the DC heroes, many of the people on the DC Earth, and it kind of takes the jumping off point of, I won't say Final Crisis, but one of the early Scott Snyder Justice League arcs, because you have that Justice League team concept, the Hawk Girl and Cyborg, and kind of a classic version of the team that everybody who reads DC would recognize. But he gets a hold of Cyborg and has Desaad implant anti-life into Cyborg. So I don't want to be spoiling too much for this, because I think it's hot off the presses here in October, where we just wrapped up issue number 6, the final chapter. But I will say it is tremendously well done for what it is. You know, I had no interest in the Marvel zombie stuff when that was coming out, apart from the initial arc as seen in Ultimate Fantastic Four back in the day. That was 20 years ago at this point almost. But this is a very well done DC zombie story. Heroes are affected, villains are affected, and you kind of get to see a survival tale from the characters. You get to see, well, what would happen if? And, you know, a lot of great characters, including one of my least favorite characters ever, Damian, get a chance to shine. This is the best Damian story I've ever read, I will say. This is the least hateable Damian I've ever read about, too. So, you know, I've liked him a little bit in Adventures of the Super Sons, but didn't care for most of him when Morrison and Tomasi and those guys wrote him with Batman and Robin. But I tell you what, I did not hate this, and I did not hate the way they characterized him here. So I think you should check this out. It should be dropping on DC Universe in a couple of months if you did not pick it up when it came out.
Oh, I am very much looking forward to fully diving into that on DCU. I was very happy that it was published under just the regular DC Comics banner instead of Black Label or Vertigo. So yeah, it should absolutely, once issue 1 is a year old, it should be dropping on DCU. I actually did buy issue 1, read it, really liked it, but at the time I was like, man, I'm really trying to cut back on the number of books I'm buying per month, so I didn't add it. But I knew this was one that would definitely make its way to DC Universe. So even though it's probably not there now, because it's only been like 6 months really since issue 1 dropped, folks, you give it another 6 months, issue 1 will be there. I think it'll hook people from the jump. I know that there's some crazy stuff that happens in that book that I've already had kind of spoiled for me. I don't want to spoil it for anybody else, but whenever I heard what was going on, I was like, dude, I got to read the rest of this. It sounds insane.
Yeah. If you're a fan of the Injustice comic books by Tom Taylor, this is kind of up that alley, but much darker, much more stuff is happening more quickly, less decompressed. That's for sure. I confess I did forget the 6 month versus 1 year rule. Marvel Unlimited is 6 months. DC Universe is 1 year. But the trade paperback for this is out very soon, and it should be around $10 or so. Yeah. But yeah, if you're paying for DC Universe, you might as well wait a few months. There's so much stuff to read and keep you busy. But definitely this book fits that horror theme, and I thought it'd be nice to get something new and fresh because I tend to live, you know, 20 to 40 years ago. Yeah. So with my recommendations.
I understand what you mean. And speaking of like 20 years ago and stuff that's actually already available on DC Universe, we're going to come to my number two pick, and that is Batman and Dracula Red Rain from 1991, written by Doug Minch and penciled by Kelly Jones. This is a pretty classic Batman team. They had a pretty storied run on the main continuity line of Batman. But this is an actual Elseworlds labeled title. The basic premise starts very much like many other Batman stories have started, with Batman investigating a series of murders. But this time, he's investigating the murders of homeless people in Gotham City whose throats have been slashed. And as it turns out, it's a family of vampires led by Count Dracula himself who have turned up in Gotham City and are, I guess their main motivation is to turn the world or turn Gotham City to a city of vampires. That seems to be where this is all headed. But a rogue vampire named Tanya is not on board with Dracula's plans, and she teams up with Batman to help him take down the vampire menace in Gotham City. Of course, some point during this story, I don't think it's a spoiler to say that Batman himself is bitten by a vampire and becomes like them. He has their strength abilities, their mental powers and stuff like that, so that he can take on Dracula directly. Now, this is a pretty classic Elseworlds title. I think a lot of people are aware of it. And Batman versus Vampires on its surface sounds like it could also go to be an action title, but this one very much plays like it's trying to emulate Bram Stoker, in that there's a lot of dream sequence horror, as I like to think of it, where you really get inside the head of the person who's being kind of like stalked and tormented by a vampiric presence. And that's something that kind of hangs like mist over all of Gotham City during the course of this story. And there is actually literal red rain falling from the skies, but it's because of rust, I believe, in the atmosphere. So it comes down like a red rain. It's a great visual. Kelly Jones is at the top of his game in this and just absolutely kills it on the artwork. Some truly like iconic Batman imagery in this, but it's also some pretty like dark and scary stuff, because you don't know what's around the next corner. And that's how Kelly Jones and that's how Doug Minch really wrote this story. But Kelly Jones is the one that's really bringing it to life and giving you that sense of dread that comes along with a good Night Stalker type story. So if that's the kind of thing that you're into, like the kind of psychological and dark thrillers that can come along inside the DC universe, this is one that I would highly recommend. It's a pretty big classic, I think, for people to go and check out. It does have sequels. Bloodstorm, which came out in 1994, also by Minch and Jones, and then Crimson Mist came out in 1998. Again, same creative team. Those other two I have not read, but Red Rain is one that is a pretty instant classic whenever you dive into it.
Yeah, Batman in a vampire story. Who'd have thunk it, right?
Right.
tremendous art by Kelly Jones. I would say nigh iconic. It's very memorable. The gauntness, the tall and thin, and the extremely elongated ears of the cowl. I remember reading that when it came out, I believe. Well, I met Kelly Jones at a Sacramento convention because he, at the time, lived not far from here. I don't know if I got that one signed, but I think I got my Sandman by him, the Season of Mists, which is, I believe, what led into this for him or got him the gig, because he was a horror artist in this tradition of Bernie Wrightson. If you look at the old Swamp Thing by Bernie Wrightson, you can kind of see where Kelly Jones got his inspiration and kind of took it to a different direction with the extreme thin, I like to call it the ribsy style. You know, there's a lot of ribs on his characters. Kelly Jones took that into a Dead Man series and even onto the main Batman book for a while. He did a lot of covers and did some actual interiors for Batman for some time during the Night Quest era, right? If I recall correctly, Greg would probably be the authority on that. But I enjoyed his work. Did not remember that it was Doug Mensch, who was quite the prolific writer of the time, did a lot of Batman. Of course, did Master of Kung Fu back in the day with Paul Gulacy, and is one of those guys who worked post Denny O'Neill in that tradition of Batman, kind of the dark detective style. And I really enjoyed Red Rain when it came out, especially the very end.
Yeah.
The very end leaves you, oh yeah, they went there. So I agree. People should check that out if they've never read it. But it is one of the classic Elseworlds stories, I would say. You know, one of the foundations of the Elseworlds era of the 90s.
And is on DC Universe right now. So
yes, it is.
That's one you can queue up and just dive right in. And believe me, it's only a single issue, too. It's just an extended long issue. And that's another thing I liked about these Elseworld titles is that they're published as like complete stories. They're not published like miniseries so much. Now we have to get to the big ones. Now we're going to get into the ones, our number one picks. So Todd, what is your scariest DC comic story?
Again, it's a story that is not on DC Universe just yet. But
one day
it was published as a DC story pre-Vertigo, and this one, of course, you knew I was going to talk Sandman. This is Sandman number 6, 24 hours. Many people talk about this comic. It's kind of this is a comic I know you've read because you've read Preludes and Nocturnes from Sandman.
That's
but
true.
This is Dr. Destiny, somewhat classic Justice League villain. Gone really wrong, taking people hostage in a diner and making them play out his deepest, darkest fantasies. And it's told within the context of a 24-hour day. Hour one, this happens. Hour two, this happens. He kills people. He doesn't bring them back to life. He does all kinds of creepy, disgusting things with them. And it's dark. Art by Mike Dringenberg, and the writer, of course, is Neil Gaiman. And this was the first time you got to really see how twisted the concepts in Sandman could present stories to you. There was, of course, a great Sandman and Hellblazer or John Constantine team up in Sandman number 3. And some people prefer that one because it's a little bit more focused. One story, very literal, very, very driving, but not jumping around like 24 hours. 24 hours is just the darkest thing I can think of in a DC comic, and it's endures to this day. People talk about that particular issue as though it changed some things within people's reading of comics, and people have even made fan films of this. You can Google and track down a person who has done this recreation of the issue within a diner, filmed it in a diner, and pretty good stuff, I must say. It inspires some dark dreams. So Sandman himself is not even in this comic until the very end. So I highly, highly recommend it. Of course, I'm jump back and recommend things from Sandman all the time. But that would be my all-time scariest DC comic.
And that, I, as you know, didn't really stick with Sandman after Preludes and Nocturnes, but it is one that I definitely intend to revisit. I was hoping that it would wind up being part of DC Universe, and it may still one day. I think it would be a great addition to the service to have it there. And I actually do remember that issue. I really liked that one because I really liked the reinvention of Dr. Destiny. And that version Destiny would go on to be the version that DC Comics would use going forward. And that version of the character appeared in the Justice League cartoon series in a pretty great episode that made Dr. Destiny just absolutely terrifying as a villain. I thought he was one of the scariest things that show ever did. So, yeah, I can definitely co-sign on that recommendation.
Part of Gaiman's genius is taking these established DC characters like the Kirby Sandman, like Dr. Destiny. In fact, I read an old Justice League annual that had both of those characters in them, and I was unaware of the connection between them, but Gaiman extrapolated on it. He also took Hector Hall from the old Infinity Incorporated and wrote him into this bigger tapestry, giving him more of a history and link to other characters that hadn't been there before. Golden Age Sandman, too. Another one of those characters. Gaiman did amazing stuff with Sandman within the DC universe. Karen Berger, editor, and the powers that be shunted it off to Vertigo, which is a great thing. It did its own thing, but then they really kind of took it outside of DC continuity at that point.
It did. I remember being like really surprised by Preludes and Nocturnes when Batman and like the Scarecrow, pretty much all of Arkham Asylum, is appearing in that first arc, and I was like,
Martian Manhunter too. I think,
like all these Justice Leaguers are appearing. I'm like, I had no idea this was in canon. I always thought Sandman just stood apart.
Mr. Miracle,
thing.
Yeah. It was very much within the DC universe. At the very beginning, you know, as was Swamp Thing, as was Hellblazer at the very beginning. So they shunted those off to Vertigo, let them kind of have their own universes, and that was their prerogative, kind of let them be more mature books. But one of the things I loved about it was how it would give you more insight to characters in DC continuity. But c'est la vie, it's gone. Boy, I would love that to be on DCU someday.
Oh, man. I actually really do, too, because I would love to just dive in and just spend, you know, all this time with the Sandman comics and really get to know them in a more, like, intimate way, I guess.
And I say I'd love to see it on DCU, and then I realize, well, I've got the original comic books. Mm-hmm. I've got them in trade paperback. I've got them in digital trades on Comixology, so
you have,
what's one more way for me? But I'm talking about for other people to be able to read it.
Absolutely. I am definitely guilty of doing the double and sometimes triple dip myself when it comes to comics that I really love. But one more, my number one comic is also, unfortunately, one that is not available on DC Universe, at least as of this recording. Big fingers crossed that maybe one day it will be, because it's written by one of DC's current big guns, a guy who's actually driving main DC continuity right now, Mr. Scott Snyder. This is the Vertigo story Vertigo series that he launched with famed horror writer Stephen King and absolutely tremendous artist Raphael Albuquerque, and that is called American Vampire. This is my second vampire story that I've picked for this, and it's kind of weird because I'm not really that big of a vampire lore fan necessarily, but it's amazing how many vampire stories I actually do really like, and this is one that I find to be equal parts intriguing from a character study standpoint, and from a just sheer, like, monster-style terror story. What makes especially the first volume or the first story arc of this so interesting to me is that it takes place in the late 19th century in the American West, with the basic premise being the old European vampires have started to make their way to America, and they wind up inadvertently creating a new strain of vampire. And that's something that the series focuses or like will explore as it goes along, how there are different strains of vampirism throughout the world. And the youngest among them is the American vampire. The first one that we know of is a kind of an anti-hero type character named Skinner Sweet, who is an American outlaw by trade. And he gets some new powers through his vampirism that others don't have. He's very Blade-esque in that regard because he is impervious to sunlight. He's stronger than them physically, and when he takes on, like, he looks normal. He looks like a regular person most of the time, except with, you know, for some pronounced canines. But he actually can undergo a bit of a transformation into a more monstrous type vampire. And that's something that the American vampire strain seems to have as an exclusive thing to itself. As this story moves along, it goes from the Old West to the 1920s, and we meet the actual POV character named Pearl Jones, who is a young lady who's a struggling actress in the silent film industry, who winds up attacked by a coven of European vampires who had been hiding out in Hollywood. They don't try to turn her. They just feed on her. And Skinner Sweet happens to be in Hollywood at this time whenever this is all happening. And he, kind of out of character for himself, takes it upon himself to save her and gives her some of his blood, which turns her into a vampire like him. Then it becomes a revenge tale where she goes on like a rampage to kill off the coven of vampires who attacked her. And it's really Raphael Albuquerque's art that sells it as this absolutely outstanding, scary type story, because the imagery that he uses for her transformations and for her moments of vengeance against these things is like, you know, at once it's kind of like, oh, well, this is just kind of sweet revenge for her, so it's kind of like revenge tale. But then when you just see how brutal she is, you're like, no, this is some scary ass shit, because once she's done with them, she's still a vampire. She's still impervious to sunlight. She can continue this on for however long it is that she's going to live. And the interesting thing that I find about this series is that it flows from one decade to the next. So you're seeing how she was in the 1920s in the first volume. But then, like, the next one moves into, I believe it's like the 1940s or 50s, something like that. But it keeps going along as we're exploring these different time periods that she's living through, and of course not aging because she is a vampire. But you're also following the kind of side adventures of Skinner Sweet, who is kind of responsible for all of this being set off in the first place. And as far as you know, in this series, Pearl is the only other American vampire that Skinner Sweet is responsible for making.
Mm-hmm.
So that in itself, I think, is really interesting. This also had several spinoff series and had a second volume called Second Cycle that picked up after the initial series ended after 34 issues. Second Cycle came out in 2014 and ran from then to 2015, ran for 11 issues. But my favorite of the spinoff series is another one that I just want to give a quick shout out to, is a series called Survival of the Fittest, which was written by Scott Snyder and illustrated by a pretty hot DC artist and writer right now, Sean Murphy. And it takes place during World War II and focuses on the case files of the vampire hunting organization known as VMS. They go and take on a bunch of Nazi vampires in a pretty great action horror six-issue mini. So I would highly, highly recommend that spinoff as well. It was actually the very first American vampire thing I ever read. And then that got me to go back and try the main book. And I was like, okay, well, I got to go check out the rest of American Vampire and see what that's like. And I was instantly hooked by it. It was so different from everything that I'd been reading at the time. Really like chilling stuff from the master of horror, Stephen King. And of course from, Scott Snyder, who is a pretty prolific horror writer in his own right as well.
So Scott Snyder either wrote or co-wrote every American Vampire project that came out?
Yes.
Okay, good. That's one that I read the first trade. Certainly remember some of the details, especially the silent film era stuff and the Hollywood stuff. But I need to go back. That's got to be something I get back into because I've read lots of Scott Snyder stuff that I love. I've read certainly Stephen King books, and I've also really enjoyed the Snyder and Murphy combination on a book called The Wake from Vertigo a few years ago. I was making a honorable mention. I'd put The Wake in there because it's kind of their underwater horror story. So, yeah, I need to get back into American Vampire. Did they leave it on a cliffhanger, or am I recalling that incorrectly?
No, I think The Wake actually does have an ending, but like a lot of horror stories.
No, I meant American Vampire.
I haven't read the final ending of it, which was an American Cycle, but I don't think that they ended it as a true ending because it's supposed to be back.
Right. That was my thinking.
Yeah. Scott Snyder has said that they're putting it under Black Label, and it's going to just continue on. It's going to pick up where they left off in Second Cycle and just keep this thing going. And I think that is really great because this is a series that anytime Scott Snyder comes back to it, he always has a fun and incredibly entertaining story to tell. So if you've never read American Vampire, I would highly recommend get on Comixology, get those trade collections. Get the spinoff miniseries. Those are all good, too. Pretty much if it's got the American Vampire name on it, you're going to get a quality story, and it's going to give you just a hell of a ride from beginning to end.
Okay, so noted. Just to recap your top three, you had Action Comics. What was the name of the story?
Under the Skin, which was
Under the Skin
by Greg Pak and Aaron Cooter. My number two was, of course, Batman Dracula, Red Rain by Doug Minch and Kelly Jones. And my number one is American Vampire from Scott Snyder, Raphael Albuquerque, and Stephen King. That's the first volume, which collects the first six issues.
All right, and my top three were House of Mystery 201, The Demon Within by Joe Orlando and Jim Aparo. Number two was Deceased number one, Tom Taylor, Trevor Harrison, and Sandman number six was my top one. 24 Hours, written by Neil Gaiman, art by Mike Drinchenberg. And that was the first non-Sam Keith-drawn Sandman issue. Again, most of mine are not available currently on DC Universe, but they are still big-time DC stories. Most are available digitally in some way or form. And you can always Google, if you're really interested in the House of Mystery, I found somebody who just had PDF'd the pages. And I'm not going to say that. I'm not going to give that the stamp of approval, but it's out there, I will say.
Yeah.
Do you have any other honorable mentions before we move on to the second half of the show after the break?
You know, I'm glad you mentioned The Wake, because that's one that I would definitely throw out there that that people
it's
should
so
check
good.
Out. That was a really well-done story. And again, the American Vampire spinoff, Survival of the Fittest, is a big one. There is a Swamp Thing series that Scott Snyder also did in the New 52 that I would highly recommend people go check out. That,
right on.
That was a big-time like body horror type story. It's a slow burn kind of story, too, and it's actually one you can find on DC Universe, so go get on that. So those would be my honorable mentions.
Yeah, I wanted to avoid some of the things I talk about a lot, but of course I went back to Sandman 24 hours. But on my list, I had the Arkham Asylum, Sirius 9 and Sirius Earth. You can't not have that in a comprehensive list of DC horror. We were just talking about Grant Morrison a bit ago, and we will talk about him later this month when we revisit Jeff Lemire's Animal Man. We'll talk about Grant a little bit. Also had Night of the Reaper, Batman issue 237. I've talked about that comic many, many times. One of my favorite Bronze Age Batman issues, despite it featuring the Rutland, Vermont Halloween Parade and Tom Fagan. Still the greatest issue that involves that concept and those characters, because it's Denny O'Neil and Neil Adams and an amazing story, amazing art and story, but I've talked about it a lot. There was also one or two things I wanted to talk about. Swamp Thing Annual number 2 from Alan Moore, Stephen Bissett, John Tottleman, classic Swamp Thing story. I won't go too much into the spoilers for people who are working their way through Swamp Thing, and a lot of people are at this point because of its kind of upsurge in popularity with the TV show.
Uh-huh.
But this is a tale where Swamp Thing gathers the mystical DC heroes of the time, Phantom Stranger, Etrigan, the Demon, lots of characters like that, and he goes on a journey to hell to save his girlfriend's soul. And it's an extra-length tale. You know, with Alan Moore writing something about hell, it's going to be extremely detailed and twisted, and this issue certainly is. Last one for me was a fairly recent issue from just before the New 52 era, and this is from Brave and the Bold, Volume 2. Well, not Volume 2, but Brave and the Bold Ongoing Series, Volume 2, written by JMS, J. Michael Straczynski, not my favorite writer, but I really enjoyed this issue, and art by Jesus Saez, and this is actually an Aquaman story.
Ooh.
You referred to Cthulhu and Lovecraftian stuff. Well, this is Aquaman encountering creatures like that, along with Etrigan the Demon. So a done-in-one story that is available on DC Universe that I would recommend you check out. Kind of took me by surprise because it was off my radar. I stopped reading that series when George Perez left that iteration of Brave and the Bold. But I would recommend checking out that JMS story because it's quite good and wonderful use of Aquaman pre-Jeff Johns.
Nice. That is definitely man. I'm actually really interested to read an Aquaman in a Lovecraftian style setting. I think that he would lend himself very well to something like that. And especially like seeing stories like The Trench from Jeff Johns and Ivan
yes.
Rice like that. That feels very Lovecraftian as well. So not what I would consider necessarily a horror story, but it has some elements of it. All right. That brings us to an end on this first half. And when we come back on the other side of the break, we're going to talk about a DC horror film that pretty divisive amongst the fandom. That would be the Constantine film that starred Keanu Reeves in the lead role. That movie came out, of course, in 2005, directed by Francis Lawrence. So don't go anywhere. We will be right back.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have over 24 podcasts available on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com. We now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation Wrestling feed, we dive into topics running the gamut from today's WWE to the glory days of yesteryear and the ins and outs of the territory days. In addition to our full-length shows, we also deliver to you special pod blasts on topics old and new.
The Place to Be Nation Pop feed is a veritable treasure trove of great content. Offer tremendous shows covering the land of movies, television, life, comics, and sports, brought to you by the most knowledgeable and insightful folks in the podcast world.
You can find all these great shows, plus archives of our past podcasts from over the past 8 years, as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while you're there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows, plus others, available on PlaceMination.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects, and much more. Be sure to support our site by using www.PlaceMination.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping. We want to thank our friends at Boneheads Wing Bar, ProWrestlingOnly.com, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com as well. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr. PlaceMination.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Well, hello, DC, for you listeners. It is I, the manager, Todd Weber, here to tell you all about what's going on PlaceToBeNation.com and our podcast feeds, starting with the Place to Be Nation pop feed. We've got our weekly shows, Hard Traveling Fanboys. We talked about the Longbook Hunters, reading a story called The Great Darkness Saga, The Legion of Superheroes versus Darkseid. Last week on DC for You, Russell and I talked about current events in DC, including Doomsday Clock, Legion of Superheroes, Millennium. This week in the NFL Hits Weekly, we've got Roger and Johnny recapping the last set of games, previewing the upcoming weekend's batch. The 49ers are still undefeated. Brand new show is on the pop feed now. Siblings Kevin and Mary host the Brother Sister Rewatch podcast. On episode 18, they bring you The Office Season 3, Episodes 7 and 8, including the merger between Scranton and Stamford. On Laugh-In Theater number 12, Andy welcomes David Sunday to the live watch. So I married an axe murderer. Harriet, unloving. Anyway, Looking Forward, Looking Back is also back with Andy Atherton. Summer movie recap and wager results. I did not win, but I should have. Andy was joined by Miranda, Scott, Tim, and Russell. Coming up soon, we've got the Place to Be Nation Tournament for Sitcoms. We want to preemptively celebrate the finals of our 80s song tournament. Matchup is Sweet Child of Mine versus Don't Stop Believin'. Do the Right Thing, vote for Guns N' Roses. Congratulations to Jennifer Smith. She's got her own pod feed starting, spinning off, breaking off, starting up. It's called the Jenny Position. I was on the first episode where we talked very fascinating things about what I can and cannot eat anymore. Certain shows will be migrating over to that, including Geek and Sassy, Talk and Pop, and Freak Out Drive-In. And I guess this is the last opportunity I have to do the Randy Savage Freak Out Drive-In, yeah. That wasn't bad, but I'm no Greg Phillips. We've got a Halloween movie challenge. We're giving you suggestions on what movies to watch leading up to October 31st. When you do, let us know by using the hashtag pound number sign PTBN Halloween Movie Challenge. Over at Wrestling, Place to Be Podcast, JT and Scott start the 90s. We love the 90s as Steve Bennett joins them for the January 15th MSG House Show. Wrestling Warzone's back. JT and Chad talking about the WCW Clash of the Champions 32, episode 30. Fifth episode of Extreme Three-Way Dance, JT, Jenny, John dance their way through three episodes of ECW Hardcore TV from March and April of 94. Main event, 134. Scott, Nate, and Steve preview the Wednesday night war between AEW and NXT, plus a New Japan Pro Wrestling Classic match pick. Ben Zani interviews Ian Riccoboni. I can't say that well. Plus the statuesque Marco and Logan stunts on episode 23 of Row 1, Seat 1, and then episode 24 had All Ego, Ethan Page, man I have met, good dude. Every Wednesday on our website, PlaceToBeNation.com, we've got the most interesting and unexpectedly funny stories on the World Wide Web in Glenn's Weekly Walk. Every Tuesday, we've got Campus Hot Takes, talking about college football's previous weekend. Go UGA. Why am I rooting for Georgia? I don't know. If you're shopping over at Amazon, click on our website, placetobenation.com first. Click our Amazon banner or just type in placetobenation.com/Amazon. Takes you right to Amazon, helps out PTBN with no cost to you. Check out our social media pages and message board at bigelow34.proboards.com. Join our GWWE pay-per-view and TV match ever project. I think you should root for or vote for Steamboat Savage from WrestleMania 3. Because it's the first good match anybody ever saw, in my opinion. Most people. Sane people. Right people. People like me. All right. Now back to DC4U.
All right, Todd. It's time to get into it. The 2005 Constantine film. Your thoughts?
So, well, let's talk about it first. Let's talk about the plot. Because I'm not going to go off on the rant you think I'm going to go off on. But I know that there are people that adore this film, and to me, as a movie, it's okay. It's an okay film, but what bothers me about it... Well, let's talk about it. So it's Constantine, and it's kind of like the classic Constantine arc, right? Where he's Spear of Destiny, and Gabriel, and Balthazar, and you know, you have him interacting with angels and demons, and saving an innocent girl. I'm trying to recall all of these.
The basic premise is that the Antichrist, the son of the devil, wants to break out of hell and establish his own kingdom. But the only way he can do that, apparently, is through using heavenly means. Like God himself would have to help him do it, which is... Of course, kind of a symbolism type thing, more so than literal in this movie's case. And I think people know that Constantine himself is an exorcist by trade, but we know him as a British exorcist. And this is decidedly not that.
No.
Because this is Keanu Reeves, of course, playing John Constantine as an American. I believe this is taking place in California.
Los Angeles.
Yeah, in L.A. So it's...
City of Angels, ironically. Not ironically. But.
And it's a pretty big change to him, but they do keep a lot of the elements that we know of Constantine. He is very much an asshole. Doesn't seem to have much empathy for other people, but at the same time, he finds himself, you know, combating the forces of evil because this is just, I guess, at his core who he is. Or he's, I guess, one of the back stories of the film is that at one time, whenever he was a kid, he tried to commit suicide, but was brought back. But that means that his soul is forever damned to hell, and he's been trying to buy his way into heaven, essentially, by banishing all of these demons and other entities back to hell. So
now, and at the setting of the film, he's running out of time because he's dying of lung cancer.
And he's just chain smoking cigarettes, which is very John Constantine.
Well, and the series Hellblazer, the classic 300 issue DC then Vertigo run, this was an arc that happened to him, written by Garth Ennis, where he's dying of lung cancer and he tricks the devil into saving him. So they loosely adapt that part of it.
Arc called Dangerous Habits from Hellblazer issues 41 through 46.
A lot of people would acknowledge that's kind of the definitive Hellblazer story, Constantine story. If you haven't read it, that's probably the best one that really encapsulates classic Constantine.
And that's one I need to go back and read. It's one that I am familiar with thanks to this movie and through reading up on what it was about, but have still never actually read it myself. And supposedly the movie also pulled from the original Sins story arc in some
just
ways.
Just for the origin aspects of it, or just kind of the setting the table and bringing in Papa Midnight as not a villain per se, more of a anti-hero ally here in this film, if I recall correctly.
Yeah, he was really different here than in any other incarnation of Papa Midnight I've ever seen.
Yeah.
And this was actually my first impression of Papa Midnight, so that's how I thought he was. So whenever I saw the actual version of the character, it was a little jarring.
Yeah.
But he was played very well by...
Jaimon, right?
Jaimon Hansu. This movie also co-starred Rachel Weisz as the female lead and slash protagonist, and Tilda Swinton played the Angel Gabriel, which was an interesting thing. But this movie also gave the world the cinematic version of Shia LaBeouf, so it will forever earn Nick's ire.
Not just Nick's.
But lots of our ire, too. This is actually probably the best Shia LaBeouf movie, honestly. He's less annoying here than he is in other things. And you at least get to see him die horribly in this movie.
Okay. All right. So, John Constantine. But it's not John Constantine. If they had just renamed the character... Because even though he has affectations, he smokes, and he's a demonologist, it's not John, and he's a jerk, it's not Constantine. I mean, his Britishness is a huge part. Is that a word, Britishness? His English?
No.
Yeah. Whoever wanted to capitalize on Keanu, who was coming off the Matrix trilogy at that point, or had he done all three at that point?
I think all three had been out, because I do remember one person I went to college with going to see this movie and coming out saying that he hated it because it was Neo Goes to Hell.
And, yeah.
And I was like, this movie didn't really like give me Matrix vibes so much. It's just unfortunate that Keanu was coming off of the Matrix at the time, which was like one of the biggest movie trilogies of the day, and now he's trying to do something... just something else, and all anybody can see is Neo.
Right. And up to that, pre-Matrix, Keanu was kind of a joke. And
yeah.
So that was kind of the start of redemption. I mean, Bill and Ted is fine for what it is, some of the other early stuff. But you look at Bram Stoker's Dracula, and Keanu tanks that film single-handedly to me. he wastes just this amazing performance by Gary Oldman and really good direction by Francis Ford Coppola, and just derails it completely every time he's on the screen. However, Matrix is great, and Neo, Keanu in the first Matrix especially, is really good. So that was kind of the start of things. And here, I won't say he's bad. I say he's adequate, but he's not Constantine. And that, just don't tell me, you know, don't tell me the sun is shining when it's raining. this character is British to the core. And even though I know Matt Ryan has done just an outstanding job as Constantine in every other incarnation since, he's pretty much been the only Constantine we've seen or heard since Keanu in this. I still wish that he had, not even him, but maybe like somebody like Colin Farrell or an actual Britishman was tied to the role, or even somebody doing a British accent, which Keanu couldn't do. It's such a part of the character through and through.
Now, at least they didn't have him
beginning.
Do that.
No, I know. That would have been even worse. So maybe this was the lesser of two evils, but it still derails the film. Secondly, Chaz is not a kid in the comics.
That's true.
He is Constantine's loyal driver, buddy, gopher, does everything for him, and is kind of has a blood debt to Constantine. And Shia LaBeouf, I don't know what they were thinking casting it this way. So those are the two main issues I have with the film. The way they did the imagery was fine. The other casting, for the most part, very, very good. Recasting Papa Midnight is not truly a villain or a rival. Maybe they were setting him up to be in a potential sequel as an antagonist. So I have a hard time just detaching myself from that, from the just the casting issues. And I can appreciate that it's pretty to look at, some good hell imagery and other good performances throughout. But I can't get past John Constantine not being John Constantine.
This was honestly my first exposure to the Constantine character. So it was something that, you know, left an impression on me, and I actually wound up really enjoying the movie, probably because I didn't know anything about the character going in. Knowing more about it, of course, I can say that Matt Ryan is such a better fit. He is truly the John Constantine that we know of the comics. He has brought that character to life on screen, and it is absolutely fantastic. This take I find just as an entertaining, almost Elseworlds take on John Constantine. He's certainly not British in any way, and it pretty much is like one of those defining characteristics that's been removed from the character. So, yeah, there is a valid complaint there that maybe he should have been cast as, like, maybe you could have still put it in Los Angeles, but just cast a British character, like a British actor, or in, like, Colin Farrell probably would have been a good choice. You know, he's Irish, but it would have been a good choice for,
right?
Because he could do a believable enough accent to pull this off. I wind up like kind of getting pulled into the story because I like that redemption arc for the character, and that's something that I kind of gravitate to for this down on his luck, kind of a prick to everybody, despite everyone trying very hard to befriend him, and everyone trying to help him, even though he's being just insufferable about it at times. The effects for the time for 2005, pretty good, pretty like, not bad. There are some sequences that probably don't age too well, but there are other sequences that I think are really well done in the cinematography. I think that the hellscape imagery, and that's actually something that I really liked about this movie, was that Constantine even himself says in the movie that heaven and hell are right here. They're just behind the veil where you can't see them. But every so often you can do something to pierce that veil, and you can see that if you just stripped away the world as people see it, that hell is actually around them all the time. They just don't know it. That in itself is a really good bit of imagery that's used throughout the movie. Good performances from Rachel Wise, even from Keanu. Keanu plays this role as it's written pretty well. Tilda Swinton is also very good as Gabriel. And of course, the breakout, though, to me, was Gavin Rosdale.
Gavin Rosdale,
As Balthazar. Total shock there. I thought, you know, oh God, they cast the lead singer of Bush in this movie. I don't know that this is going to work out too well. And then, holy shit, he's actually pretty good.
Yeah, he's to me the best thing in the movie. He and Swinton. But, you know, I'm just thinking about this movie. Do you think the plot was too complicated for people with all the warring factions of hell? And
I didn't think so.
Keeping everybody straight? Okay.
I didn't think it was. I felt like I could keep up with that pretty easily. And, you know, not knowing anything about the plot or the background of these characters coming into it, I had an easy time keeping up with what was going on, that you had these multiple factions in heaven and hell, each with their own agendas. And the movie, I think, does a good job of not getting too in the weeds on that. It just, much like how, and I'm going to use another Keanu film series to kind of illustrate this, John Wick sets up a pretty expansive or potentially expansive universe in its first movie, but doesn't overwhelm you with it. It just says this stuff exists in its background, and if we get a chance to explore it in sequels, we will, but we don't necessarily have to if we don't get picked up to go further. Constantine kind of does the same thing. It gives you a taste of this world, shows you these different factions that exist all around the character, and says, hey, if we get picked up for sequels, we could explore some of this stuff and really like flesh it out in a bigger way. Constantine, unfortunately, did not get the opportunity to do that, but John Wick got to do that in a big, bad way and has continued making good movies ever since.
I think maybe if we had really an origin story, like how did he dabble into the occult and then lose his soul, much like we've seen in the Constantine series and, again, alluded to in Legends, might be more interesting to me. But, you know, they had one shot at this, so they go for the big thing. They have the actual devil in the film.
They do. They bring him in, and I'm trying to remember that actor's name that played him.
It's a guy from Fargo. What's his name? The wood chipper guy. Peter Stormare.
Peter Stormare. I loved his take on Satan.
Yeah, pretty good.
He only gets the one scene in the movie, but it is real, real good. And I think that was one of Keanu's best scenes in the movie too.
That scene kind of like the big showdown, because Lucifer has a mat on for Constantine. Like, he's the only guy that he would ever come to Earth to collect. He hates Constantine so much. And then he's forced to listen to him and tell him that Lucifer's son is planning to usurp him with this whole plan throughout with the spear and everything. I won't liken it to the diner scene from Heat, Michael Mann's Heat with De Niro and Pacino, you know, the great adversary squaring off, but it is pretty cool. This, one hero versus the ultimate evil scene personified. Yeah. It was interesting. And then Lucifer is forced to help Constantine, which is kind of fun.
Yeah, there was that bit of trickery I thought was pretty great.
That is somewhat out of the Dangerous Habits story.
Yes. It is very in line with the character of Constantine. So he still has a lot of the same methodology and reactions that we would expect from a very classic style Constantine, just without the Britishness of it all, which of course winds up being a big factor that's missing. But we have discussed some good points. Another good point of this movie that I personally liked, I don't know if you're going to be quite as on board with it, but this movie had some pretty good use of music. It gave me my favorite Perfect Circle song, which is called Passive, which I think is a pretty great tune from them. It's actually played at one point in the movie. I think that between that and the imagery of the film and most of the performances, we've covered the good points. We've covered some of the bad as well. So do you think this movie has any, since this is our horror movie month, do you think this movie has any like really scary moments? Because I got one in mind that still freaks me out.
The heel turn. There is a heel turn in the movie that kind of, I'll say it's dread. And actually seeing hell, being in hell, was pretty freaky.
The hellscape stuff is definitely freaky. The demons themselves, like the little soldier demons that are running around, all look like pretty freaky. But the one scene that still gets me is when Constantine takes Rachel Weisz's character out for a dinner one night after he's himself gone into to hell and back. He's telling her about when he first realized there was something different about himself, that he could see like kind of dead people and like demons and stuff like that walking around on Earth. He could see them, and then he realized that they could see him. He's on a bus as a kid, and he's seeing this old lady kind of turn around, and then her face kind of melts away, and you see the demon face looking back at him. And he's tripping. He's freaking out, and he closes his eyes real quick, thinking that it's a dream, that he can make it go away. When he opens his eyes, she's not there anymore, and he starts to lean back, and then she like appears right behind him, kind of screaming in his ear. And that still is like one of the best, like real scary moments of the film to me. That one still gets me.
So somebody should make an alternate. Oh, hey, Lucy. Somebody should make an alternate audio track for this where Sting or someone dubs in the dialogue for Keanu.
You know, somebody probably would have tried to do that. I could see that actually being.
Maybe it's on YouTube. But yeah. So I don't recall that particular moment. I'll check it out. Speaking of checking it out, this film is now on DC Universe.
Yes, it was added back in the summer. Surprisingly enough, they would have put it on during, you know, in the hottest part of the year instead of waiting for, you know, this time of year, Halloween. But it's whatever. It is worth checking out. I think people should go, you know, at least watch it once. See what you think. Go into it with an open mind is the best possible way you can approach it. If you are a longtime hardcore John Constantine fan, yeah, probably not gonna have that great a time. I could see you just not being into it. But if you have no knowledge of the character whatsoever, I would recommend check this out, and then of course go watch the Constantine television series that is also on DC Universe. That stars Matt Ryan as a very British Constantine, a very British and blonde Constantine, which is much more in keeping with the character's traditions. So,
I'm trying to think anything else I can say about this. They changed the name of the film. Could have been at that point, Constantine had only appeared in books that he starred in under the title John Constantine: Hellblazer. So it was trade, you know, Hellblazer issue 1, issue 2, issue 3. Mm-hmm. They did not call this movie Hellblazer because it was too similar to the Clive Barker franchise Hellraiser.
That and Hellboy was a thing at the time.
That's true.
And they did not want to have further brand confusion brand confusion was a thing they were worried about, and like possibly having people think that this is all like takes place in the same universe when it very
right.
It very much does not. That was I think that Hellblazer would have been a better name for this movie, but at least this movie was rated R. This was very much that R-rated take on Constantine that you might expect. They did not try to PG-13 this one down.
And it was a modest success. I mean, $100 million budget in 2005 dollars, but it made 300 worldwide, so not terrible.
It only made 230.
Million. Oh, 230?
Yeah,
okay. I don't know where I got that 300 one. Okay, so it made its money back barely, and then maybe its advertising costs. That's what's up. Okay.
Yeah, that's
sorry.
I think why it didn't get a sequel. They didn't consider this to be profitable enough, and that's a pretty respectable budget for this movie. Like $100 million, yeah, you could definitely get you a good Constantine movie out of that. Hell, I think you could make a pretty good Constantine movie for about, 50, 60 million today.
Yeah.
I think you could absolutely do that with, you know, not going too heavy on the hellscape stuff and focusing more on, like, practical effects.
Mm-hmm.
You could absolutely make a better Constantine movie. And boy, what I wouldn't give to have Matt Ryan return in an actual like R-rated Constantine capacity.
Yeah, and I will say, when Matt Ryan was first cast and we saw those first issues or first episodes of the Constantine TV show, and since the movie, I should say, they've gone back, they've had the word Constantine as the title of his comic book character. They brought him back into the DC universe and put him in Justice League Dark. They don't use the Hellblazer phrase too much anymore, even though that was very much a Vertigo thing. It's like they rebranded him to tie into the movie and the name recognition of the movie. But even the first Matt Ryan episodes, I struggled with it just a little bit. It felt like he was trying a little too hard. He does ultimately reveal himself to be, I really don't care bastard. and that is Constantine through and through. But he does, he has a soul. He's so much better than Keanu as the Constantine we've read that I just wish that was the first mainstream version of Constantine people had gotten to see.
And that's fair. He is really, really great in that role. And I've loved that they brought him on to Legends of Tomorrow. And people who are reading comics now, they'll be happy to know that a Hellblazer series is joining the Sandman family over in DC Black Label. So John Constantine is headed back to his outside
mature
of,
readers,
yeah,
roots,
the mature yeah. readers roots. Like it's going to be a very much mature readers comic. Very classic Hellblazer style, written by Cy Spurrier, who I believe is British, and will be happening right alongside his other Sandman book, The Dreaming, which I read the first issue of a while back and really, really enjoyed it. So I think that there's a lot of good stuff going on there in the comics. And of course, if you watch this Constantine movie and you really like it, go see if you can find yourself copies of Dangerous Habits that this movie very much pulled from. It was issues 41 through 46, written by Garth Ennis and illustrated by Will Simpson. So that's going to be a good one for you to go check out. It'll probably make you an even bigger fan. And definitely check out the Constantine TV series and always watch Legends of Tomorrow. Keep that show going. It deserves higher ratings. It's a really great show.
I'm hammering it to death. The other thing about British Constantine is that so many of the writers that created him were British and had that unique sensibility. In fact, no prominent American writer did anything with him until Brian Azzarello, if I recall correctly. But you had guys like Neil Gaiman, Garth Ennis,
Alan Moore.
Alan Moore, the creator of him, who based him on Sting.
Yep.
Grant, I don't think Grant has done a whole lot with him, but Jamie Delano, a lot of classic writers in the I want to say the Vertigo hierarchy, you know, the guys who are best known, and Garth Ennis is primarily the one I'm thinking of. Like, he did his first real work. You see the seeds of his Preacher run in his Hellblazer comics. So that's one of the reasons I'm so loyal to the British iteration of the character, is that so many British writers injected that sensibility into him.
Yeah, and he's, I mean,
Warren Ellis, there's another one.
And I mean, now that I'm much more familiar with the Constantine character than I was back in 2005, having experienced him in comics, actually in comics written by Jeff Lemire, when he was part of Justice League Dark.
Dark, right.
Which was, Justice League Dark was a title in the New 52 that didn't really get off to a great start to me. It was just okay. But when Jeff Lemire takes the book over, it really starts to sing. And he wrote a really good Constantine, so I would very highly recommend people go check that out too. Artwork by Mikhail Janin as well, so the art is freaking fantastic.
Okay, but that's, I'm done.
But in any case, that is what we're going to talk about. That's what we're going to say on Constantine. It's an up and down. It's a mixed bag of a movie, but you should go check it out and see what you think for yourself if you haven't already. It's on DC Universe, so well worth checking out. With that, that brings us to an end here on this first episode of our DC Horror Showcase Month. When we come back next week, we're going to take a look at a New 52 title. We're going to be taking a look at Animal Man number 1 from Jeff Lemire and artist Travel Foreman. That is one of the big bright spots of the New 52. And definitely a bit of a surprise, because Animal Man is kind of thought of as a bit of a goofy superhero in a lot of ways, but this title is anything but. So we hope you'll be back with us on another episode of, what is it, Todd?
DC for you.
DC for you.